session number 17324, Reel 2.
Wajak Reel 2.
Well, we were living in a very small area, it was congestion, but not only that, the place was infested with some small animals. I'm not sure what is the name of it is in English, but there are those which live in the wood and come out at night and suck your blood like hell. So there was nightmare with this. You get used to it after time. One cleans it, and maybe at the end of our stay there, it was bearable. But the first few months were very difficult. In that area in Arkhangelsk, the winter lasts for about 9 months, but it's dry, and there was no flies or any other infestation from the insects. But during the 3 months summer, it was a nightmare because of the flies and other small
insects.
In this video I make, we can see many people. It was summer, it was June, people doing this all the time, you know, putting away the flies and insects, and it was very, very hard, because the summer was very short, but it was very, very hot. In the administration of the settlement, our commandant who was Russian, belonging to NKVD, I think was in the rank of major, his name was Pierre Rogov. He only had about two more helpers, and because we were very far away from any other area, it would seem that we were not guarded, but of course we could not travel to any other area. And the commandant was a very kind man. He would try to help us in case of difficulties, but he had kept very strong discipline. We had to go to work, and our supervisors at work in the woods were people who were deported to Soviet Union or to that area in 1930s. Many of them were of Polish origin, and I remember one who was called Slabetsky. He came from Belorussia at that time. Okay, our supervisor was Mr. Slabetsky, who was about 40 at that time, whose family was deported to the area where we were in 1930s. He understood Polish, did not speak it very well, but his mother spoke very good Polish, and his father was dead at that time, I believe. And there were a few other supervisors who were also of the Polish origin from Belorussia. Now, he was very interested in us, especially in youngsters. We had to do the norms in whatever you did. There was always norms. There were always norms. And he would help us with extra norms and things, and would talk to us very often. And he would ask how we lived in Poland, what did we do, and ask us about the West. Because in that area, there was hardly any communications. Newspapers were only Russian newspapers, Izvestia or Pravda. And he was very hungry about news about Poland. And we were young, and we said that in spite of our being deported, we are sure that we will go back to our homes sooner or later, that Germany will be defeated, and there will be some arrangements with Soviet Union that will go to our homes. And Mr. Slavetsky used to say that, you see this river Dvina, if it starts to flow south, then you will go back to Poland. I am not surprised he said that, because he was young when he was deported. The only life he knew was in woodlands, and that probably was the impression of all the people who lived there, who could not imagine other life, could not imagine that they could go somewhere else. We had with us some people who were working in the woods before the war, before deportation, and they also would be supervising our work, and they were very friendly with Mrs. Lavetsky and other people in the camp. The work consisted, or it lasted every day from about dawn to dark, or from about 8-9 o'clock in the morning. We had to walk to our workplace in the snow, and would come back. It was almost dark. We were given small rations of bread. If you did your norm, you would get about 500 grams of bread or 400 grams of bread, which is about a pound. And maybe you would be given soup and a light meal in the evening when they had supplies. Towards the end of our stay, the food supplies were meager, and those people who could not exchange some of the belongings with the local communities or exchange between themselves, they really started to starve. That was maybe at the beginning of 1941. My family was very lucky, because those families who said goodbye to us in Zdolbunov before deportation, they were sending us parcels. And we received maybe, until the beginning of the Russian-German war, maybe 10-12 of those parcels, which were very well packed. They were sewn with the material, and they usually consisted of honey, of butter, and lard, things that we needed and which helped us tremendously. Families who were not receiving the parcels, they really suffered. Now, we were away from the nearest Russian, or not Russian, other settlement, or people who were there before, maybe 10 kilometers, and occasionally the commandant would give us permission to go and take something to sell and bring maybe some potatoes or something like that. So he was quite human in that respect. The children who went to school, they probably were given one or two meals a day. But again, towards the end of our stay there, the things became difficult. My younger brother was 7 when he was deported. By the time we were leaving, was 8 and a half, and already you could see that he was undernourished, and other children as well. And also we were, because our food was not very plentiful, we suffered with some illnesses which you could not see very well, for example, in the evening. And maybe these insects also didn't help. But on the whole, in my settlement, there were not many deaths from the Yeluga where I stayed. A lot of people were frostbitten or died by accidents, but there were no deaths by starvation. And we heard that some other camps in Arkhangelsk where commandants maybe were not so good, or maybe supplies had taken time to arrive from Kotlas or other big town, and towards the end of the deportation time, people suffered. We were trying to remember our country, so we used on the national days where we would have meetings in the barracks, not official meetings, that was forbidden, but we would remember our Constitution Day or Remembrance Day, which is on the same day as in England, 11th of November. And also we would sing religious songs. There was no church, of course, there was no priest amongst us, so we would sing the religious songs and maybe remember time on Sundays we used to go to church. And our commandant was not against it. In other areas, in other camps, I believe this was forbidden.
Was the socialist or communist economic system or political system apparent to you at all?
Well, it was so far away from mainland Russia, and there was only one industry, and you could see shortages of everything, of tools for work in the woods. The transport would not be improving, and the distribution of food and other things were very poor. So we did not think that in that area things are managed very well. But again, we had no newspapers, we had no wireless, we could not learn very much about how Soviet Union existed, how it worked. I think we probably could get impression of it when we left our camps and we were traveling through Soviet Union to the south to join the Polish army. Then probably could have a better glimpse of life and organization, but not at the time that we were in exile in the camps.
Can we come on now to the outbreak of the Soviet-Nazi war?
Yeah. As I said, we had no newspapers, but Mrs. Slavetsky used to bring a newspaper occasionally, so we could read about the progress of war in the West, but very scantily. When the Russian-German war started, Mrs. Slavetsky rushed in with the newspaper to say that war has started, that already there were rumors that he and his age, people of his age, would be recruited to the army. And it was the first time that he admitted that maybe we shall leave the area. And for many weeks nothing happened. We were still asked to work, but already even the commandant was to leave, so he was not as scrupulous or as looking after the order as before. So there was some disorganization, but we were not allowed to leave the camps. It was only in July and August of 1941 that we were asked to a meeting, and the commandant told us about the Polish Soviet Union agreement and said that we would be given amnesty. And it was great joy, of course. We had some rumors of it before he told us this. And he said that we could leave the camps and to go south. But he suggested that the men would go first and then we would follow. And my father left in August of 1941 to go to Kotlas, and then he traveled towards southern Russia to Tashkent and Samarkand area. We did obtain from the commandant was that he went to the army and that we could follow him. And without this certificate, it would be very difficult later on to travel through Soviet Union. And we were waiting for some news from our father, but nothing came. In October, November 1941, we decided to go to Kotlas, and it was allowed. On the way to our Yeluga camp, we were taken by the sledges and the horses, but we had to go on our own on foot to Kotlas, and we had a small sledge on which we put the rest of our belongings, and my youngest brother, who was then 8 and a half. Or nearly 9, and we traveled every day 10 to 20 kilometers, again near Dvina, because Dvina was frozen, and we were given a place to sleep by various settlers or some villagers. They could not give us much to eat, but at least we could sleep overnight and then travel again. It took us maybe, I can't remember, but 10 or 15 days to get to Kotlas. And where we were nearing Kotlas, we could see a lot of people, because most of the Poles who were given amnesty, they all were going towards Kotlas by various routes, by trains, by rivers, but mainly walking. And we, wherever we went to Kotlas, we made our way to the railway station, because that's where we were going to go south. And there were hordes of people, and you could not get accommodation. So we would look for accommodation in private housing and in schools. And it took us about a week before we could buy tickets, sell some of the belongings that we still had to buy tickets. We had to wait at the railway station day and night before the train came, and we boarded also wagon trains, but they were better than those used in 1940 when we were deported to Soviet Union. The journey south lasted a few weeks, because the trucks or the wagons would be shunted for days on the sidelines or even in the middle of nowhere, and we had to wait to be coupled into other transports to go south, because that was the main action of the war, that there were a lot of trains traveling with soldiers and equipment and the supplies. So we as refugees we were not treated with priority. And at the railway stations we could always get the hot water called kipyatok. It was provided by all the stations free, and that's one good thing about the system, that if you could get the hot water at the stations. The food we had with us was going down, and we were going south, and the trains were dirty, we had lice, and we were hungry. And my youngest brother Zbigniew, he started to be unwell after we left Kotlas, and by the time we got south, within 2 or 3 weeks, he was sick, and he would not want to eat, he was getting paler, and we believe that he died of typhoid or typhus or typhoid. You could not leave your train or your wagon, because you could be left behind. So we just left him in one of the stations. I can't even remember the name of the station. He was wrapped in a white sheet and left with the master of the railway station, and he was buried, we don't know by whom. And when we were going south, the climate was becoming warmer, but we were becoming dirtier and more lice, and we were taken off the train near Tashkent, and we said we're going to the army, but the authorities said no, you cannot go now, you have to go to work in one of the farms. And we spent a few weeks or maybe months gathering cotton from the fields. Kazakhstan or these areas are very warm, and a lot of insect infestations, and I don't know what is better, winter or the heat. And in the south we were living in a barrack. We slept on the floor, and our supplies of food were getting down, and we were giving just occasionally some bread and some soup. And if it was not for the later move to the army, I don't think we could last very long in that settlement on the farm. I remember that we were sleeping one night, and someone entered and we didn't hear it, and they stole our last suitcase with documents, and there were no food, there were documents and things. Ever since that time I had to rely on some documents which were signed by others that they knew me, and my matrication was lost, and many other things. So we were not too far away from the forming army, which was in Kermine, and I left to join the Polish army in Kermine, and left my family, my mother, my sister and a brother in this Uzbek settlement. And I was only 18, not even 18 when I joined the army, but they took me to the army, to infantry, and after a few days I got typhus as well, and typhoid manifests itself that I was at the meeting, standing in the line, and I just fell down, and that's how typhus starts, and you lose consciousness, and I was taken to hospital, and I was there for a few weeks, and luckily I survived. But many people died of typhoid or other illnesses once they were in the army, and once there was hope to go away, although we did not know at that time that we would be sent to Persia.
About what date have we reached now?
We're now early 1942. My mother, when I was in the army, when I got better, visited me, and already we knew that my mother and my sister and brothers could go with the General Anders to Persia. And I left for Persia in early March 1942. We had to go to Krasnovodsk by trains, and there we took a ship which was very congested, very dirty, and I landed in March 1942 in Pakhlevi in Persia. My mother and my sister and brother were lucky to join the transport end of March, and they were sent to Tehran. And myself, I was rejoined. I was in the army, so I was sent to Iraq. And then, because I had typhoid, I was sent to Palestine to recover to the convalescent camp.
What impression did Persia make on you after the USSR?
Well, it is all of us looked like skeletons. I have had a photograph of me taken in Krasnovodsk. I was very thin, and most of our people were nearly at their end. People were traveling from north to the south to join the Polish army in rags, starving, and many more, I think, died in the camps for refugees in the southern part of Russia when they were going to join the Polish army than in the camps in the north. Krasnovodsk, we had to give all our money. We were in line, always in line. You could not go anywhere, and it seemed that this freedom would never come. We spent one day in Krasnovodsk before we put on a boat, and we all expected freedom. We all thought, we're going, and everybody was afraid that maybe something happens that will be sent back. And when we landed in Pakhlevi, there was a sort of feeling of elation, of people were kissing the sands. They were joyful, although very, very of poor health. And we had to go through the day infestation, is the word? The infestation. We all had to have our hair shorn, all our clothing had to be thrown away, and we were given new clothing on the other side of the barrack or whatever. We were given food, but as we were not used to eat, to see so much food, and mainly it was rice and very fat lamb, so people would really suffer from stomach ailments because you could not control yourself, and it's amazing how after a few days when we recovered a bit, how we thought, where's my father, where's my mother, where are my brothers and sisters? So immediately we started to look to try to find them.
Could we jump ahead now finally to one final incident, which is when you were shipwrecked in a vessel leaving South Africa for Britain called, I think, the SS Laconia.
That's correct.
Can you describe how the ship was sunk and when it was, please?
Sure. As I said, I was sent to Palestine to a convalescent camp, and after 3 months convalescent, I joined the officers' cadet school, and I was sent to South Africa on Mauritania, which was a phenomenally big ship, with some other Polish soldiers. There were 4,000 of them, 4,000 of us. We mainly were going to be sent to UK as supplement for the Army, Air Force and Navy, because most of the refugees, or those who left Soviet Union with Jill Anders, stayed in Middle East, and then they were fighting in Italy, Monte Cassino and other places. 4,000 of us were sent to UK. We all landed in South Africa in Durban, and we were sent to Pietermaritzburg, which was a beautiful town, and maybe 100 miles away from Durban. We were settled in a camp, army camp, for about 2 months. That was probably from about June to late August, and the camp was also really a convalescent, because most of the people only came out of Russia in the last few months. Immediately, the people in Pietermaritzburg took to us, and they would come to the camp, and after a week or two, everybody had a friend in Pietermaritzburg and could spend weekends with them, and we could rejoin and get used to a normal meals, normal sleep, and normal life. The soldiers were transported to UK by ships, which were usually sailing on their own, not in convoys, but there were many submarines in near Atlantic, near the African coast. And most of the convoys got through all right. Usually they had to zigzag between the U-boats, and majority of people got to England between September and maybe February of 1943. I left Durban in August 1942, and we were put on the SS Laconia, which was a Cunard liner, about 20,000 gross tons, and we were to take Italian prisoners of war to Canada. But you had to sail along western coast, and Laconia was quite a fast boat, but not as fast as probably Mauritania or others, or other bigger boats. And the ship was torpedoed on 12th of September 1942. I have described the life on the boat in my book, in my memoirs. We till 12th of September, we were sailing for about 12 days, and we were guarding the Italians, and it was quite interesting, our conversations and our duties and everything else. But one night the ship was torpedoed. It was in the evening, about 8 o'clock. We had two torpedoes in the ship, and it took maybe 1 hour for the ship to